trees and began to keep pace with the car, flying lazily about 30 feet above it. He kept his eye on the little town of Baker now approaching, made a quick judgment as to the coasting distance the car could travel, and then at the right moment he hurled his sword like a fiery spear downward. The sword traveled a perfect trajectory and shot through the hood of the car. The engine died.
"Nuts," said Marshall, shifting quickly into neutral.
"What's wrong?" Bernice asked.
"Something's broke."
Marshall tried to restart the engine as the car continued to coast along. No response.
Probably electrical, he muttered.
Better pull over at that station.
Yeah, I know.
The Buick limped into the little filling station in Baker and rolled to a stop right at the front door. Marshall opened the hood.
I'm going to excuse myself, said Bernice.
Go for me too, will you?
Marshall said crossly, looking here and there around the engine compartment. Bernice went to the next little building, the Evergreen Tavern. Age and settling were slowly swallowing it from the bottom up, and one end was badly sunken. The paint on the front door was peeling. The neon beer logo in the window still worked, though, and the jukebox inside was twanging some country hit. Bernice pushed the door open. The bottom scraped a worn arc across the linoleum, and went inside, twisting her nose a little at the blue cigarette smoke that had replaced the air. Just a few men sat in the establishment, probably the first of the logging crews getting off work. They were talking loudly, swapping stories, cussing it up. Bernice looked directly toward the back of the room, trying to find the little men and women signs. Yes, there was restrooms. One of the men at a nearby table said,
"Hey, baby, how's it going?"
Bernice wasn't going to even look in his direction, but did just happen to give him a glance and an appropriately dirty look. A little too much local color in this place, she thought. She slowed her walk, her eyes locked on him. He looked back at her with a boozy, lazy-eyed smile on his bearded face. Another man said,
"Looks like you got our attention, buddy."
Bernice kept looking at him. She approached the table and took an even closer look. The hair was long and tangled, bound into a ponytail with a rubber band. The eyes were glassy and now heavily lined. But she knew this man. The man's friend said,
"Good evening, ma'am. Don't let him bother you. He's just having a good time, right, Weed?"
"Weed?" Bernice asked. "Kevin Weed?"
Kevin Weed just looked up at her, enjoying the view and saying little. Finally he said,
"Can I buy you a beer?"
Bernice came closer to him, made sure he could clearly see her face.
"Do you remember me? Bernice Kruger?"
Weed only looked puzzled.
"Do you remember Pat Kruger?"
A light slowly began to dawn in Weed's face.
"Pat Kruger. Who are you?"
"I'm Bernice, Pat's sister. Do you remember me? We met a couple of times. You and Pat's roommate were going together."
Weed brightened and smiled, and then he cursed and excused himself.
"Bernice Kruger, Pat's sister."
He cursed again and excused himself again.
"What are you doing in this place?"
"Just passing through. And I will take a small Coke, thank you."
Weed smiled and looked at his friends. Their eyes and mouths were getting wide, and they were starting to laugh. Weed said with a leer,
"I think it's time you boys found another table."
They gathered up their hard hats and lunch boxes and laughed.
"Yeah, you got it, Weed."
"Dan,"
Weed hollered,
"a small Coke for the lady here."
Dan had to stare for a moment at the nice girl who had come into a place like his. He got the Coke and brought it to her.
"So, what have you been doing?"
Weed asked her. Bernice had her pen and notebook out. She told him a little about what she had been doing and what she was doing now. Then she said,
"I haven't seen you since before Pat's death."
"Hey, I'm really sorry about that."
"Kevin, can you tell me anything about it? What do you know?"
"Nothing much. No more than what I read in the papers."
"What about Pat's roommate? Do you hear from her anymore?
Bernice noticed Weed's eyes widen and his mouth drop open the moment she mentioned the girl.
Man, this world is getting smaller all the time, he said.
You saw her?
Bernice couldn't believe her good fortune.
Well, yeah, sort of.
When?
Bernice insisted.
But just for a little while.
Where? When?
Bernice was having a very difficult time holding herself back.
I saw her at the carnival.
In Ashton?
Yeah, in Ashton. I just ran into her. She called my name, and I turned around. There she was.
What did she say? Did she say where she's living now?
Weed fidgeted a little.
Man, I don't know. I don't really care. She dumped me, you know. Ran off with that other goon. She was even with him that night.
What was her name again?
Susan. Susan Jacobson. She's a real heartbreaker, she is.
Do you have any idea? Did she give you any idea of where I might find her? I have to talk to her about Pat. She might know something.
Man, I don't know. She didn't talk to me for very long at all. She was in a hurry, had to meet her new boyfriend or something. She wanted my phone number. That was about it.
Bernice couldn't let go of her hope. Not yet.
Are you sure she didn't give you some idea of where she's living now, or any way to get in touch with her?
Weed shrugged drunkenly.
Kevin, I've been trying to find her for ages. I've got to talk to her.
Weed was bitter.
Talk to her boyfriend, that fat little geezer with all the bucks.
Oh, no. That wasn't really a legitimate hunch that ran through Bernice's mind.
Or was it? Kevin, she said, what did Susan look like that night?
He was staring off into space like a drunken and jilted lover.
Foxy, he said. Long black hair, black dress, sexy shades.
Bernice felt her stomach tighten into a knot as she said,
And what about her boyfriend? Did you see him?
Yeah, later. Susan acted like she didn't even know me when he came into the picture.
Well, what did he look like?
Like some wimp from Fat City. It had to have been his money. That's why Susan latched on to him.
Bernice picked up her pen in a shaking hand.
What's your phone number?
He gave it to her.
Address?
He mumbled that off, too.
Now, you say she asked you for your phone number?
Yeah, I don't know why. Maybe things aren't working out with Loverboy.
Did you give it to her?
Yeah, maybe I'm a sucker, but yeah, I did.
So she just might be calling you.
He shrugged.
Kevin,
Bernice gave him one of her cards.
Listen carefully to me. Are you listening?
He looked at her and said yes.
If she calls, if you hear anything from her at all, please give her my name and number and tell her I want to talk to her. Get her number so I can call her. Will you do that?
He took the card and nodded.
Yeah, sure.
She finished her coke and prepared to leave. He looked at her with his dull, glassy eyes.
Hey, you doing anything tonight?
If you hear from Susan, call me. We'll have plenty to talk about then.
He looked at her card again.
Yeah, sure.
A few moments later, Bernice was back at the filling station just in time to see Marshall start the car up. The old and bent station owner was looking at the engine and shaking his head.
Hey, that did it!
Marshall shouted from behind the wheel.
Heck, I didn't do a thing, said the old man.
High above the filling station, Nathan soared skyward to join Armoth, his sword retrieved.
Done, he said.
And now we'll see how the captain and Gilo succeed in New York. The Buick started out again, and Nathan and Armoth followed behind and above it like two kites on strings.
Chapter 18 Hank started the Sunday morning service with a good rousing song, one Mary performed on the piano particularly well, Both were in good spirits and feeling encouraged. In spite of the approaching sounds of battle, they sensed that God, in his infinite wisdom, was indeed working out a very mighty and effective plan for reestablishing his kingdom in the town of Ashton. Victories large and small were in the making, and Hank knew it had to be the hand of God. For one thing, this morning he would be ministering to an almost entirely new congregation. At least it sure felt that way. Many of the old dissenters had dropped out of the church and taken their embittering presence with them, and the whole mood and spirit of the place had risen several notches because of their absence. Sure, Alf Brummel, Gordon Mayer, and Sam Turner still hovered around, brooding together like some kind of hit squad, but none of them were in the service this morning, and a lot of new fresh faces were. The Forsythes' example had been followed by their numerous friends and acquaintances, some married couples, some singles, and some students. Grandma Duster was there, as strong and healthy as ever, and ready for a spiritual fight. John and Patty Coleman were back, and John couldn't keep from grinning in his joy and excitement. Of the rest, Hank had only met one. Next to Andy and June, looking a little sheepish, sat Ron Forsyth, along with his girlfriend, a short, very made-up sophomore. Hank had to choke down some very strong emotion when he saw the Forsythes enter, accompanied by their son. It was a miracle, a genuine act of grace by the living God. He would have shouted hallelujah right there, but he didn't want to scare the young fellow away. This could be one of those kid gloves cases. After the first song, Hank figured he might as well address the situation before him. "Well," he said informally, "I don't know whether to call all you people visitors or refugees or what." They all laughed and exchanged glances. Hank continued, "Why don't we just take a moment here to introduce ourselves? I guess you probably know who I am. I'm Hank Bush, the pastor, and this flower sitting at the piano is my wife, Mary." Mary stood quickly, smiled meekly, then sat down again. "Why don't we go around the room here and tell everybody who we are?" And the first roll call of the remnant took place as the angels and demons watched. Creone and Triscoll stood at their posts right beside Hank and Mary, while Cigna and his squad, now numbering 10, kept a hedge about the building. Again, Lucius had carried on a bitter argument with Cigna, trying to gain admittance. But he knew better than to push the matter too far. Hank Bush was bad enough, but now he had a whole church full of praying saints. The heavenly warriors were enjoying their first real advantage. Lucius finally ordered his demons to remain outside and hear what they could. The only demons that had managed to enter had come in with their human hosts, and now they sat here and there in the congregation, brooding over this horrible development. Cyan stood near the back like a hen watching over her brood, and Seth stayed near the Forsythes and the group with them. There was power in this place today, and everyone could feel it grow as each new person stood and introduced himself. To Hank, it seemed just like the gathering of a special army.
"Ralph Metzer, sophomore at Whitmore."
"Judy Kemp, sophomore at Whitmore."
"Greg and Eva Smith, friends of the Forsythes."
"Bill and Betty Jones, we run the Whatnot Shop over on 8th Street."
"Mike Stewart, I live with the Joneses and I work out at the mill."
"Cal and Ginger Barton, we're still new in town."
"Cecil and Miriam Cooper, and we're sure glad to see you all here."
"Ben Squires, I'm the guy who brings you your mail if you live on the west side."
"Tom Harris, and this is my wife Mabel. Welcome to all of you, and praise the Lord."
"Clint Neal, I work at the filling station."
"Greg and Nancy Jenning, I teach. She's a writer."
"Andy Forsyth, and praise the Lord."
"June Forsyth, and amen to that."
Ron stood to his feet, put his hands in his pockets, and looked at the floor a lot as he said,
I'm Ron Forsythe, and this here is Cynthia, and I met the pastor at the cave, and
his voice cracked with emotion.
"I just want to thank you people for praying for me and for caring."
He stood there for a moment looking at the floor while tears welled up in his eyes. June stood beside him and addressed the group on his behalf.
Ron wants you all to know that he and Cynthia gave their hearts to Jesus last night.
Everyone smiled with delight and murmured encouragement, and that loosened Ron up enough to say, "Yeah, and we flushed all our drugs down the toilet." That brought down the house. With increased joy and fervor, the roll call continued. Outside, the demons listened with great alarm and hissed exclamations of foreboding.
"Rafar must know of this," one said.
Lucius, his wings half unfurled just to keep his fussing ranks from pestering him, stood still and brooded. One little demon hovered about his head and cried out,
"What shall we do, Master Lucius? Shall we find Rafar?"
"Back to whatever you are doing," he hissed back. "Let me see to informing Baal Rafar myself."
They gathered around him, wanting to hear his next order. Lately, it seemed he had spoken so very little.
"What are you all staring at?" he shrieked. "Go, do mischief. Let me worry about these petty little saints."
They flurried away in all directions, and Lucius stood in his place outside the church window. Tell Rafar, indeed. Let Rafar humble himself enough to ask. Lucius would not be his lackey. In this part of New York City, things were tailored for the elite and discerning. The shops, boutiques, and restaurants were the exclusive kind, the hotels quite lavish. Carefully groomed flowering trees grew in round stucco planters along the sidewalks, and maintenance workers kept the streets and walks spotless. Among the hurried shoppers and browsers crowding the district were two very large men in tan tunics, strolling the sidewalk and looking here and there. "The Gibson Hotel," Tal read on the front of an old, distinguished stone building that towered 30 stories above them. "I see no activity," said Gilo. "It's early yet. They'll be along. Let's be quick about this." The two of them slipped through the big front doors and into the hotel lobby. People passed on all sides of them, and sometimes right through them, but that, of course, was of no consequence. Within moments, they had checked the schedule at the desk for the hotel's banquet facilities and verified that the grand ballroom was reserved that night for the Universal Consciousness Society. "The general's information was right," Tal commented with pleasure. They hurried down a long, thickly carpeted hallway, past a barbershop, a beauty salon, a shoeshine nook, and a gift shop, and at length came to two huge oak doors with lavishly wrought brass handles. They passed through and found themselves in the grand ballroom, now filled with dining tables adorned with crystal place settings and white linen tablecloths. One lone, long-stemmed rose in a bud vase stood on every table. The hotel caterers were hurriedly making final preparations, setting out the artfully folded napkins and wine glasses. Tal checked the place cards at the head table. One, towards the end, said, "Kasif, Omni Corporation." They went through a nearby exit door and looked right and left. Down the hall, to the left and toward the back of the hotel, was the ladies' lounge. They went in, past a few women primping at the mirrors, and found what they were after, the very last stall designated for use by the handicapped. It was built against the rear wall of the hotel, just below a window large enough for a limber human to crawl through. Tal reached up, broke the lock, and tested the window to make sure it would open and close easily. Gilo passed quickly through the wall into the alley, where he found a large dumpster and, with incredible ease, moved it several feet so that it was situated below the window. He then arranged some crates and garbage cans in a very handy stair-step fashion against the dumpster. Tal joined him, and the two went up the alley to the street. Down one block was a phone booth. Tal picked up the receiver and made sure everything was functioning.
"Here they come," Gilo warned,
and they leaped through the wall of a department store and peered out a window, just as a long black limousine and then another began an ominous parade down the street toward the hotel. Inside the limousine sat dignitaries and other VIPs from many different nations and races, and within and on top were demons, large, black, warty, and fierce, their yellow eyes darting warily in every direction. Tal and Gilo watched with fascination. In the sky overhead, other demons began flocking to the hotel like swallows, their black-winged outlines silhouetted against the reddening sky.
"A significant gathering, Captain," said Gylo.
Tal nodded and continued watching. Amid the limousines were many taxis, also carrying a vast cross-section of humanity. Orientals, Africans, Europeans, Westerners, Arabians, people of great power, esteem, and dignity from all over the world.
"As written in the scriptures, the kings of the earth," Tal observed, "being made drunk with the wine of the great harlot's immorality."
"Babylon the Great," said Gylo. "The great harlot, arising at last."
"Yes, universal consciousness. The world religion, the doctrine of demons spreading among all the nations. Babylon revived, right before the end of the age.
Hence the return of the Prince of Babylon, Raphar."
"Of course.
And that explains why we were called. We were the last to confront him." Gylo only winced at that.
"My captain, our last battle with Raphar is not a pleasant memory."
"Nor a pleasant expectation."
"Do you expect him here?"
"No, this gathering is only a party before the real battle, and the real battle is slated for the town of Ashton."
Tal and Gylo remained where they were, watching the gathering forces of mankind and of satanic evil converge on the Gibson Hotel. They kept looking for the one key person, Susan Jacobson, Alexander Kasif's maidservant. They finally spotted her in a very fancy Lincoln Continental, probably Kasif's private vehicle, driven by a hired chauffeur. She was accompanied by two escorts sitting on either side of her.
"She'll be closely watched," said Tal.
"Come on, we need a better look."
They stalked quietly through the department store, through walls, displays, and people, then ducked under the street and came up inside the restaurant right across from the hotel's main door. All around them, well-dressed people sat at quiet, candlelit tables eating expensive French cuisine. They hurried to a front window right next to an older couple enjoying seafood and wine, and watched as the Lincoln carrying Susan pulled up in front of the hotel. Susan's door was opened by the red-coated doorman. One escort got out and extended his hand to help her disembark. She stepped out and was immediately joined by the other escort. The two tuxedo-clad escorts were very handsome, but also very intimidating. They kept very close to her. Susan wore a very loose-fitting evening gown that draped her body stunningly and cascaded to her feet. Gylo had to ask, "Are her plans the same as ours?" Tal answered assuredly, "The general has yet to err." Gylo only shook his head in apprehension.
"To the alley," said Tal.
They moved along under a cracked, cobbled alley and surfaced to a hiding place behind a fire escape. Night had fallen, and it was very dark in the alley. From their vantage point, they could count 20 pairs of shifting yellow eyes evenly spaced along the alley and against the hotel.
"About 100 sentries are around the place," said Tal.
"Under better circumstances, a mere handful," Gylo muttered.
"You need only concern yourself with these 20.
Gylo took his sword in his hand. He could feel the prayers of the local saints.
"It will be difficult," he said. "The prayer cover is limited."
"You don't have to defeat them," answered Tal. "Just get them to chase after you. We need the alley clear for just a few moments." They waited. The air in the alley was still and dank. The demons moved very little, remaining at their posts, mumbling back and forth in different languages, their sulphurous breath forming a strange, meandering ribbon of yellow vapor that hung along the alley like a putrid river floating in midair. Tal and Gylo could feel themselves getting more and more tense, like ever-tightening springs with each passing second. The banquet must be in progress by now. At any time, Susan could excuse herself from the table. More time passed. Suddenly, both Tal and Gylo felt the prompting of the spirit. Tal looked at Gylo, and Gylo nodded. She was on her way. They watched the window. The light from the ladies' lounge shone brightly through it.
They could just barely hear the sound of the door opening and closing as patrons came and went. The door opened. High heels clicked on the tile floor, moving toward the window. The demons began to stir a little, muttering among themselves. The door to the last stall swung open. Gilo's hand gripped his sword. He began to breathe deeply, his big torso heaving in and out, the power of God coursing through him. Their eyes were riveted on the window. The demons became more alert, their yellow eyes wide open and darting back and forth. They were talking louder. The shadow of a woman's head suddenly appeared on the window. A woman's hand reached for the latch. Tal touched Gilo on the shoulder, and Gilo instantly dropped into the ground. Only a fraction of a second passed.
"Yaha!"
came the sudden deafening war cry from Gilo's powerful lungs, and the whole alley instantly exploded in a blinding flash of white light as Gilo shot up out of the ground, his sword flashing and shimmering, tracing brilliant arcs in the air. The demons jumped, hooting and shrieking in terror, but recovered immediately and drew their swords. The alley echoed with the metallic ringing, and the red glow of their blades danced like comets on the high brick walls. Gilo stood tall and strong, and he bellowed out a laugh that shook the ground.
"Ho, ho, ho, ho! Now, you black lizards, I'll test your mettle!"
A big spirit on the end shrieked out an order, and all 20 demons converged on Gilo like starving predators, their swords flashing and their fangs bared. Gilo shot straight up out of their midst like a slippery bar of soap and added an agile spin as he went, throwing light everywhere in colorful spirals. The demons unfurled their wings and shot up after him. As Tal watched, Gilo looped and corkscrewed all over the sky like a loose balloon, laughing, taunting, and teasing, staying just out of their reach. The demons were in a blind rage by now. The alley was empty. The window was opening. Tal was beneath the window in an instant, unglorified and concealed in the darkness. He grabbed Susan the moment her hand came through the window and pulled so hard she practically shot through the window on his strength alone. She was dressed in a simple blouse and jeans and had small slippers on her feet. From the neck up, she was still gorgeous. From the neck down, she was ready for running down dark alleys. Tal helped her find her way down from the dumpster and then prodded her up the alley and out to the street, where she hesitated, looked this way and that, and then spotted the phone booth. She ran like the wind in a terrible and desperate hurry. Tal followed her, trying to stay as concealed as possible. He looked back over his shoulder. Gilo's diversion had worked. For now, Gilo was the main problem for the demons, and their attention was far from this one frantically running woman. Susan leaped into the booth and slammed the door behind her. She took a pile of coins from her jeans pocket, dialed the operator, and put through a long-distance call. Somewhere between Ashton and the little roadside of Baker, in a run-down warehouse refashioned into low-rent apartments, Kevin Weed was awakened from an exhausted sleep by the ringing of his phone. He rolled over on his mattress and lifted the receiver.
"Yeah? Who's this?"
he asked.
"Is this Kevin?"
came the desperate voice on the other end. Kevin perked up a little. It was a woman's voice.
"Yeah, that's me. Who's this?"
In the phone booth, Susan looked up and down the street fearfully as she said,
"Kevin, this is Susan. Susan Jacobson."
Kevin was beginning to wonder about all this.
"Hey, what do you want with me anyway?" "I need your help, Kevin. I don't have much time. There isn't much time."
"Time for what?" he asked very dully.
"Please listen. Write it down if you have to."
"I don't got a pencil."
"Then just listen. Now, you know about the Ashton Clarion, the newspaper in Ashton?"
"Yeah, yeah, I know about it."
"Bernice Kruger works there. She's the sister of my old roommate, Pat, the one who committed suicide."
"Oh, man, what's going on around here?"
"Kevin, will you do something for me? Will you get a hold of Bernice Kruger on the Clarion and..." "Kevin!"
"Yeah, I'm listening."
"Kevin, I'm in trouble. I need your help."
"So where's your boyfriend?"
"He's the one I'm afraid of. You know about him. Tell Bernice all about Alexander Kasif. Everything you know."
Kevin was nonplussed.
"So, what do I know?"
"Tell her what happened.
You know, between us, with Kasif, the whole thing. Tell her what Kasif's up to.
I don't get this.
I don't have time to explain. Just tell her. Tell her that Kasif is taking over the whole town. And let her know I have some very important information about her sister, Pat. I'll try to reach her, but I'm afraid the Clarion phone might be bugged. Kevin, I need you to be there to answer the phone, to...
Susan was frustrated, full of emotion, unable to select the right words. She had too much to say in too little time.
You're not making a whole lot of sense, Kevin muttered. You on something?
Just do it, Kevin, please. I'll call you again as soon as I can, or I'll write or do something. But please call Bernice Kruger and tell her everything you know about Kasif and about me. Tell her it was me she saw at the carnival.
How am I supposed to remember all this stuff?
Please do it. Tell me you'll do it.
Yeah, okay, I'll do it.
I've got to go. Goodbye.
Susan hung up the phone and dashed out of the booth. Tal followed her, ducking inside the buildings as much as he could. He reached the alley a few moments ahead of her to check it out. Trouble. 4 more sentries had moved in to take the place of the original 20, and they were fully alert. There was no way of knowing where Gylo and the 20 might be. Tal looked behind him. Susan was running full speed for the alley. Tal dove headfirst through the pavement and penetrated deep under the city, gaining speed, bringing forth his big silver sword. The power of God was increasing now. The saints must be praying somewhere. He could feel it. He had only seconds, and he knew it. He checked his bearings, made a wide subterranean sweep away from the hotel, and then, over a mile away, he circled back, gaining speed, gaining speed, gaining speed, shining light, building power, faster, 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 his sword a blinding lightning bolt, his eyes like fire, the earth a blur around him, the roar of passing clay, boulders, pipe, and stone like a freight train. He held the sword crossways, the glimmering tip ready for that one infinitesimal moment. Quicker than a thought, like the explosion of a missile, a brilliant streak of light burst from the ground across the street and seemed to cut space in half as it pierced through the alley and right across the eyes of all 4 demons. The demons, stunned and blinded, fell to the ground, stumbled about, tried to find each other. The streak of light vanished back into the ground as quickly as it came. Susan came around the corner and into the alley, heading for the window. Tal cupped his wings and braked himself. He had to get back to help her through that window before any demons could recover and sound an alarm. He snapped his wings into a violent forward rush and doubled back. Susan clambered up the crates and cans and onto the dumpster. The demons started to regain their vision and were rubbing their eyes. Tal emerged behind the fire escape, trying to judge the remaining time. Good. Gylo made it back and dropped like a hawk into the alley, grabbing Susan and thrusting her through the window in an instant, holding her up so she would not tumble to the floor inside. Gylo closed the window himself. Tal flew out to meet Gylo.
One more time! He shouted.
Nothing more needed to be said. The 4 sentries had recovered and were pouncing on them, and the other 20 had returned hot on Gylo's trail. Tal and Gylo shot into the air and streaked away, chased by a flock of frothing demons. The angels flew a course high over the city and kept their speed just slow enough to encourage the demons. They headed west, off into the dark night sky, trailing brilliant white streaks behind them. The demons were tenacious in their pursuit for hundreds of miles, but eventually Tal looked back and found that they had given up the chase and returned to the city. Tal and Gylo picked up speed and headed for Ashton. In the ladies' room, Susan hurriedly rolled up the legs of her jeans, took her evening gown from its hook in the stall, and quickly resumed her proper appearance for the banquet. She removed the slippers and put them in her handbag, slipped on her dress shoes, then opened the stall door and came out. A man's voice outside the lounge door called,
"Susan, they're waiting for you!"
She checked her appearance in the mirror, combed her hair, and tried to calm her breathing.
"Hasty, hasty,"
she called teasingly. With ladylike dignity, she finally emerged into the hallway and took the arm of the escort.
He led her back to the grand ballroom, now filled with people, and showed her to her seat at the head table, giving the other escort a reassuring nod.
Chapter 19. The Clarion office was finally recovering the nice, healthy efficiency Marshall liked to see, and the new girl, Carmen, had a lot to do with it. In less than a week, she had taken the old bull by the horns and had more than filled Edie's shoes, re-establishing a tight office routine. It was only Wednesday, and already the paper was in full swing, heading for the Friday edition. Marshall stopped by Carmen's desk on his way to the coffee machine. She handed him some fresh copy and said, "This is part of Tom's article." Marshall nodded.
"Yeah, the thing on the fire department."
"I'd broken it down into three headings, staff, history, and goals, and figured we could run it in three parts. Tom already has it slotted for the next two pay stubs and thinks he can bump something for the third."
Marshall was pleased.
"Yeah, go with it. I like it. I'm glad you can read Tom's writing."
Carmen had already proofread the bulk of the material for Friday and was halfway through preparing the copy for George, the typesetter. She had gone through the books and balanced all the accounts. She planned on helping Tom with the paste-up tomorrow. The negatives for the Sportsman's Club layout were ready. Marshall shook his head with happy amazement.
"Glad to have you aboard."
Carmen smiled.
"Thank you, sir."
Marshall went to the coffee maker and poured two cups of coffee. Then it dawned on him. Carmen had found the cord to this fool machine. He took the two cups back toward his office and gave her a smile of approval as he passed her desk. The location of her desk had been her only request on the job. She had asked if it could be moved to a location right outside Marshall's office door, and Marshall was happy to comply. Now all he had to do was turn and holler, and she would spring into action to do his bidding. Marshall went into his office, set his cup of coffee on his desk, and offered the other cup to the long-haired, slightly dazed man sitting in the corner. Bernice sat in the chair she had brought in, with her own cup of coffee.
"Now, where were we?"
Marshall asked, sitting at his desk. Kevin Weed rubbed his face, took a sip of the coffee, and tried to pick up his thoughts again, looking around the floor as if he had dropped them down there somewhere. Marshall prompted,
"Okay, let me at least make sure I've got this straight. Now, you used to be the male acquaintance of this Susan, and she used to be the roommate of Pat Kruger, Bernice's sister. Have I got that right?"
Weed nodded.
Yeah, that's right."
"So, what was Susan doing at the carnival?"
"Beats me. Like I said, she just came up behind me and said hi, and I wasn't even looking for her. I couldn't believe it was her, you know."
"But she got your phone number, and then she called you last night."
"Yeah, all tripped out, shook up. It was wild. She didn't make a lot of sense."
Marshall looked at both Weed and Bernice and asked Bernice,
"And this is the same ghostly-looking woman you photographed that night?"
Bernice was convinced.
"The descriptions Kevin gave me match perfectly the woman I saw, and also that one older man who was with her."
"Yeah, case of..." Kevin said the name as if it tasted bad.
"All right."
And Marshall made a list in his mind.
"So, let's talk about this case of first. Then we'll talk about Susan, and then we'll talk about Pat."
Bernice had her notepad ready.
"What's Casef's full name? Any idea?"
Weed strained his brain.
Alexander, something like that."
"But it starts with an A."
"Yeah, right."
Marshall asked,
"What is he?"
Weed answered,
"Susan's new boyfriend, the guy she dumped me for."
"So what does he do? Where does he work?"
Weed shook his head.
"I don't know. He's got bucks, so he's a real wheeler-dealer. When I first heard about him, he was hanging around Ashton in the college and talking about buying property and stuff. Man, the guy was loaded, and he liked everybody to know it, too."
Then he remembered.
"Oh, and Susan said he's trying to take over the town."
"What town? This one?"
"I guess.
Bernice asked. So, where is he from?
Back east, maybe New York. I think he's a big city type.
Marshall told Bernice, make a note for me to call Al Lemley at the Times. He might be able to track this guy down if he's in New York. Bernice made the note. Marshall asked Weed, what else do you know about him?
He's weird, man. He's into weird stuff.
Marshall was getting impatient.
Come on, try harder.
Weed stirred and fidgeted in his chair, trying to get comfortable about talking.
Well, you know, he was like a guru or witch doctor, some kind of far-out ooga-booga man, and he got Susan into all that stuff.
Bernice prodded. Are you talking about Eastern mysticism?
Yeah.
Pagan religions, meditation?
Yeah, all that stuff. He was into all that stuff. He and that professor lady at the college, what's her name?
Marshall was sick of the name. Langstrat. Weed's face brightened with recollection.
Yeah, that was it.
Were Kasif and Langstrat associated? Were they friends?
Yeah, sure. They were teaching some night classes together, I think. The ones that Susan was going to. Kasif was a special guest star or something. He really had everybody wowed. I thought he was spooky.
All right, so Susan was attending these classes.
And she got crazy, and I mean crazy, man. She couldn't have been on a higher trip with mescaline. I couldn't even talk to her anymore. She was always way out in space somewhere.
Weed kept talking, starting to roll a little on his own.
That's what really started to get me, how she and the rest of that bunch started keeping secrets and talking in codes and not letting me in on what they were talking about. Susan just kept telling me I wasn't enlightened and wouldn't understand. Man, she just gave it all to that Kasif guy, and he took her. I mean, he really took her. He owns her now. She's gone. She's had it.
And was Langstrat mixed up in all this?
Oh, yeah, but Kasif was the real heavy. He was the guru, you know. Langstrat was his puppy dog,
Bernice said.
And now Susan gets your phone number and calls you after all this time?
And she was scared, said Weed. She's in trouble. She said I was supposed to get in touch with you guys and tell you what I knew, and she said she had some information on Pat.
Bernice was longing to know.
Did she say what kind of information?
No, nothing, but she wants to get a hold of you.
Well, why doesn't she just call?
That question helped Weed to remember something.
Oh, yeah. She thinks your phone might be bugged.
Marshall and Bernice were silent for a moment. That was a comment they didn't know how seriously to take. Weed added,
I guess she called me to be a go-between to tip you guys off.
Marshall ventured,
like you're the only one she has left to trust?
Weed only shrugged. Bernice asked,
well, what do you know about Pat? Did Susan ever tell you anything while you were still going together?
One of Weed's most painful undertakings was trying to remember things.
She and Pat were good friends for a while anyway, but... You know, Susan left us all out in the cold when she started following after that Kasif bunch. She kind of pushed me off, and Pat, too. They didn't get along very well after that, and Susan kept saying how Pat was just like me, trying to get in the way, not enlightened, dragging her feet.
Marshall thought of the question and didn't wait for Bernice to ask it.
So, would you say that this Kasif bunch may have regarded Pat as an enemy?
Man, Weed remembered some more. She did stick her neck out. I mean, she got in the way. Her and Susan had a real fight once about the stuff Susan was getting into. Pat didn't trust Kasif and kept telling Susan she was brainwashed.
Weed's eyes brightened.
Yeah, I talked to Pat once. We were sitting at a game, and we talked about what Susan was getting into and how Kasif was controlling her, and Pat was really shook up about it, just like I was.
I guess Pat and Susan really had some fights about it, until Susan finally moved out of the dorm and ran off with Kasich. Boy, she dropped out of her classes and everything.
So, did Pat make any enemies? I mean, real enemies.
We'd kept digging up new things that had been buried under the years and the alcohol.
Yeah, maybe she did. It was after Susan ran off with this Kasich guy. Pat told me she was going to check the whole thing out once and for all, and I think she may have gone to see that Professor Langstrat a few times. A little later, I ran into her again. She was sitting in a cafeteria on campus, and she looked like she hadn't slept in days, and I asked her how she was, and she would hardly even talk to me. I asked her how her investigation was going, you know, her checking out Kasich and Langstrat and stuff, and she said she'd quit doing anything about that, said it was really no big deal. I thought that was a little weird. She'd been so torn up about it before. I asked her, "Hey, are they coming after you now?" And she wouldn't talk about it. She said I wouldn't understand. Then she said something about some instructor, some guy that was helping her out, and that she was doing okay, and I got the message she didn't want me butting in, so I just sort of left her there.
Did her behavior seem strange to you? Bernice asked. Did she seem like herself?
No way. Hey, if she hadn't been so against that whole Kasich and Langstrat bunch, I would have thought she was one of them. She had the same kind of dopey, lost-in-space look all over her.
When? Just when was it that you saw her like that?
We knew, but hated to say it.
Just a little while before they found her dead.
Did she seem afraid? Did she give you any indication of any enemies, anything like that?
Weed grimaced, trying to remember.
She wouldn't talk to me, but I saw her once after that and tried to ask her about Susan, and she acted like I was some kind of mugger or something. She hollered, leave me alone, and tried to pull away, and then she saw it was me, and she looked all around like somebody was following her.
Who? Did she say who?
Weed looked at the ceiling.
Oh, what was that guy's name?
Bernice was leaning forward, hanging on his words. There was somebody.
Thomas, some guy named Thomas.
Thomas, did she ever say his last name?
Don't remember any last name. I never met the guy, never saw him, but he sure must have owned her. She acted like he was following her all around, talking to her, maybe threatening her, I don't know. She seemed pretty afraid of him.
Thomas, Bernice whispered. She said to Weed, is there anything else about this Thomas, anything at all?
I never saw him. She didn't say who he was or where she'd meet him, but it was kind of strange. One minute she'd be talking like he was the greatest thing that ever happened to her, and then the next minute she'd be hiding out and saying he was following her.
Bernice got up and headed for the door. I think we might have a college roster somewhere.
She began rummaging around in the desks and shelves of the front office. Weed fell silent. He looked tired. Marshall reassured him.
You're doing fine, Kevin. Hey, it's been a while.
I don't know if this is important.
Consider everything important.
Well, this stuff about Pat having some new instructor. I think some of the Kasich bunch, maybe it was Susan, they had instructors.
But I thought Pat didn't want anything to do with that group.
Yeah, that's right.
Marshall shifted directions.
So, where did you fit into all these goings-on, besides your relationship with Susan?
Hey, nowhere. I didn't want anything to do with him, man.
Were you going to the school?
Yeah, taking accounting, man. When all this started coming down and then Pat killed herself, hey, I got out of there fast. I didn't want to be next, you know.
He looked at the floor.
My life's been nothing but hell ever since.
You working?
Yeah, logging crew for Gorse Brothers up above Baker.
He shook his head.
I didn't think I'd ever see Susan again.
Marshall turned to his desk and searched for some paper.
Well, we'll have to keep in touch. Let me have your number and address, at work and at home.
Weed gave Marshall the information.
And if I'm not there, you can probably find me at the Evergreen Tavern in Baker.
Okay, listen. If you hear anything else from Susan, you let us know, day or night.
He gave Weed his card with his home phone number added. Bernice came back in with the roster.
Marshall, you have a call. I think it's urgent, she said.
Then she turned to Weed.
Kevin, let you and I step outside and go through this roster. Maybe we'll find that guy's full name.
Weed stepped outside with Bernice as Marshall picked up the phone.
Hogan, he said.
Hogan, this is Ted Harmel.
Marshall scrambled for a pencil.
Hi, Ted. Thank you for calling.
So you talked to Eldon.
And Eldon talked to you.
Harmel sighed and said,
You're in trouble, Hogan. I'll give you one interview. Got a pencil handy?
I'm ready. Shoot.
Bernice had just said goodbye to Weed and seen him to the door when Marshall emerged from his office with a scribbled-on piece of paper in his hand.
Any luck?
He asked.
Zilch. There are no Thomases of any kind, first or last name.
It's still a lead, though.
Who was that on the phone?
Marshall produced the scrap of paper.
Thank God for small favors. That was Ted Harmel.
Bernice brightened considerably as Marshall explained.
He wants to see me tomorrow, and here are the directions. It must be way back in the sticks. The guy is still paranoid as all get out. I'm surprised he didn't make me wear a disguise or something.
He wouldn't say anything about all this?
No, not over the phone. It has to be just the two of us, in private.
Marshall leaned over just a little and said,
He's another one who thinks our phone might be bugged.
So, how do we make sure it isn't?
Make that one of your assignments. Now here's the rest of them.
Bernice grabbed her notepad off her desk and made her list as Marshall spoke.
Check the New York phone book.
I did. No A. Kasif listed.
Scratch that one. Next, check around with the local real estate offices. If Weed's right about Kasif looking for property around here, some of those people might know something. And I'd look around in the commercial listings as well.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're at it, find out what you can about whoever owns Joe's Market.
It's not Joe?
No, the place used to belong to Joe and Angelina Carlucci. C-A-R-L-U-C-C-I. I want to know where they went and who owns the store now. See if you can get some straight answers.
And you were going to check with your friend at the Times.
Yeah, Lemley.
Marshall added a note to his piece of paper.
That it?
That's it for now. In the meantime, let's get back to running this paper.
All the time, all through their meeting with Weed and their following conversation, Carmen sat at her desk busily working and acting like she hadn't heard a word. The morning had been tight, with the next issue's deadline galloping up on them. But by noon, the paste-up was ready to go to the printer, and the office had a chance to resume its normal pace. Marshall put in a call to Lemley, his old comrade-in-arms at the New York Times. Lemley got all the information Marshall had on this strange character Kasif, saying he'd get right on it. Marshall hung up the phone with one hand and grabbed his suit jacket with the other. His next stop was his afternoon appointment with the reclusive Ted Harmel. Bernice drove off for her appointed stops. She parked her red Toyota in the parking lot of what used to be Joe's Market and was now called the Ashton Mercantile, and went into the store. About a half hour later, she returned to her car and drove away. It had been a wasted trip. No one knew anything. They only worked there. The manager wasn't in, and they had no idea when he would be back. Some had never heard of Joe Carlucci. Some had, but didn't know whatever happened to him. The assistant manager finally asked her to quit bothering all the employees on company time. So much for getting any straight answers. Now it was off to the realty offices. Johnson Smythe Realty occupied an old house remodeled into an office on the edge of the business part of town. The house still had a very charming front yard with a redwood tree standing tall in the middle of it and a quaint log cabin mailbox out front. It was warm and welcoming inside and quiet. Two desks occupied what used to be the living room. Both were empty at the time. On the walls hung bulletin boards with snapshots of house after house, with cards below each photograph describing the building, the property, the view, nearness to shopping, and so forth. And, last but not least, the price. Boy, what people would pay these days for a house. At a third desk in what used to be the dining room, a young lady stood and smiled at Bernice.
"Hi, can I help you?"
she asked. Bernice smiled back, introduced herself, and asked,
"I need to ask a question that might seem a little odd, but here goes. Are you ready?"
"Ready."
"Have you done any business with anyone by the name of A. Kasif in the last year or so?"
"How do you spell that?"
Bernice spelled it for her, then explained.
"You see, I'm trying to get in touch with him. It's just a personal matter. I was wondering if you might have a phone number or address or anything."
The young lady looked at the name she had just written on a piece of paper and said,
"Well, I'm new here, so I sure don't know, but let me ask Rosemary. In the meantime, might I have a look through your microfiche?"
"Sure. You know how to run it?"
"Yes."
The lady went toward the back of the house where Rosemary, apparently the boss lady, had her office in a back bedroom. Bernice could hear Rosemary talking on the phone. Getting an answer from her might take a while. Bernice went to the microfiche reader. Where to start? She looked at a map of Ashton and vicinity on the wall and found the location of Joe's Market. The hundreds of little celluloid plates were arranged by section, township, quarters, and the street numbers. Bernice had to do a lot of looking back and forth to get all the numbers off the map. Finally, she thought she might have found the right microfiche to put into the viewer.
"Excuse me?" came a voice.
It was Rosemary marching down the hall toward her with a grim expression on her face.
"Miss Kruger, I'm afraid the microfiche is only for the use of our staff. If there's something you'd like me to find for you..."
Bernice kept cool and tried to keep things flowing.
"Sure, I'm sorry. I was trying to find out the new owner of Joe's Market."
"I wouldn't know."
"Well, I thought it might be on the machine here somewhere."
"No, I don't think so. It's been a while since the files have been updated."
"Well, could we look anyway?"
Rosemary totally ignored the question.
"Is there anything else you'd like to know?"
Bernice stood firm and unshaken.
"Well, there was my original question. Have you done any business with anyone named Kasif in the last year or so?"
"No, I've never heard the name."
"Well, perhaps someone else on your staff. They've never heard it either."
Bernice was about to question that, but Rosemary interrupted with,
"I would know. I know all their accounts."
Bernice thought of one other thing.
"You wouldn't have a cross-reference file, would you?"
"No, we don't,"
Rosemary answered very abruptly.
"Now, is there anything else?"
Bernice was tired of being nice.
"Well, Rosemary, even if there was, I'm sure you would not be able or willing to supply it. I'm leaving now, so breathe easy."
She left hurriedly, feeling very lied to.
Chapter 20 Marshall was beginning to worry about his shock absorbers. This old logging road had more potholes than surface. Apparently, it wasn't used that much anymore by the logging companies, but was left to hunters and hikers who knew the area well enough to keep from getting lost. Marshall did not. He looked again at the scribbled directions and then at the odometer. Boy, the miles go by slowly on roads like this one. Marshall bumped his way around a gravelly corner and finally saw a vehicle ahead parked alongside the road. Yes, an old Valiant. It was Harmel. Marshall pulled up behind the Valiant and got out. Ted Harmel got out of his car, dressed in clothing for the outdoors. Wool shirt, faded jeans, work boots, a wool cap. He looked the way he had sounded, exhausted and very scared.
"Hogan?" he asked.
"Yeah," said Marshall, extending his hand. Harmel shook it and then turned away abruptly.
"Come on with me."
Marshall followed Harmel to a trail off the road, and they hiked up among the tall timber, picking their way through logs, rocks, and underbrush. Marshall was wearing a suit, and his shoes were definitely the wrong kind for this sort of terrain. But he wasn't about to complain. He'd recaptured the big fish that got away. At last, Harmel seemed satisfied with their seclusion. He went to a huge fallen log, weathered and bleached by years of changing seasons, and sat down on it. Marshall joined him.
I want to thank you for calling me, Marshall said for an opener.
We never had this meeting,